In a world where uncertainty reigns supreme, where shadows of chaos dance at every turn, one truth emerges unyielding. Preparation is not a luxury, but a lifeline. Behold the Wellness Company, a beacon of readiness amidst the tempestuous seas of fate. Envision a sanctuary of tranquility, where the tumult of unforeseen medical crises finds no purchase. The Wellness Company's Medical Emergency Kit stands as a bastion of assurance, a fortress of resilience against the unseen foes of health. Within its sacred confines lie the tools of salvation. Ivermectin, to ward off the insidious whispers of disease. Emergency antibiotics, to quell the raging storms of infection. Antivirals, to vanquish the relentless tides of contagion, and more. The Wellness Company Medical Emergency Kit is not merely a collection of supplies, it is the embodiment of preparedness itself. Crafted by the hands of esteemed healers led by luminaries such as Dr. Peter McCullough, Dr. James Thorpe, Dr. Harvey Risch, and Dr. Drew Pinsky, this kit stands as the pinnacle of safety, the zenith of prevention. These truth-seeking doctors have forged a testament to vigilance, a testament to the unwavering pursuit of well-being. Embrace the certainty that comes from being armed against adversity. Embrace the Wellness Company, for in its embrace lies the promise of resilience, the promise of a brighter tomorrow amidst the chaos of today. Don't wait for the next crisis to strike. Visit twc.health/strangeplanet and use promo code STRANGEPLANET for an exclusive 10% discount. Prepare today and rest easy tomorrow.
Do you want to know what it's like to hang out with MS-13 in El Salvador? How the Russian mafia fought battles all over Brooklyn in the 1990s.
Or what about that time I got lost in the Burmese jungle hunting the world's biggest meth lab? Or why the Japanese Yakuza have all those crazy dragon tattoos? I'm Sean Williams.
And I'm Danny Gold. And we're the hosts of the Underworld Podcast. We're journalists that have traveled all over, reporting on dangerous people and places. And every week, we'll be bringing you a new story about organized crime from all over the world.
We know this stuff because we've been there. We've seen it. And we've got the near misses and embarrassing tales to go with it. We'll mix in reporting with our own experiences in the field, and we'll throw in some bad jokes while we're at it.
The Underworld Podcast explores the criminal underworlds that affect all of our lives, whether we know it or not. Available wherever you get your podcasts.
Have you ever wondered what it's like to be buried in an avalanche?
Weird foreign feeling of despair.
Or how it feels to crash a skydive?
I remember hearing a thud, feeling my body hit the ground.
Or how you would react if you were being attacked by an alligator.
At the end of my leg is this huge alligator head on my leg.
These are the stories you'll hear on the podcast called What Was That Like? True stories told by the actual person who went through it. You'll hear from a victim of an attack.
Dragging me into the bathroom and saying, I'm going to kill you. Now you're going to die.
You'll hear from a man who discovered a baby.
How could this be? How could there be a baby on the ground?
And you'll hear actual 911 calls.
Plinky County 911. There's a man at my back door. He's trying to get in.
What Was That Like is a podcast about real people in unreal situations. Search for What Was That Like on any podcast app or at whatwasthatlike.com.
Conspiracy Unlimited with Richard Serrett.
On this episode, a college professor and author takes on Darwin's theory of evolution. He reveals how some scientists are gathering the courage to question its scientific merit.
They can look up this book, Life Itself, Its Origin and Nature, by Francis Crick. This is the co-discoverer of DNA. And Crick himself says that he does not believe that DNA had a natural cause. He says it's too complex. He says, I see no natural cause. Basically, what he's doing is throwing Darwin under the bus.
This podcast is supported by Paranormal Contractors. If you have unwanted paranormal activity in your home or business, it's time to bring in the professionals. Call them at 1-866-724-0800, 1-866-724-0800, or email them at paranormalcontractors@gmail.com. Check out their YouTube channel, Paranormal Contractors, for things that go bump in the night.
Conspiracy Unlimited with Richard Serrett. Pursuing the truth wherever it leads. Exposing evil and corruption and the secret machinations of powerful elites. revealing the high strangeness beneath the surface of our supposed reality. Coming to you from his studio beneath the stairs, here's Richard Serrett.
Welcome to your Monday. Jeffrey K. Lyons, PhD, the author of Evolution Myths, A Critical View of Neo-Darwinism, is standing by. Hope you enjoyed Coast to Coast AM. Sunday night into Monday morning, I had quite an interesting conversation with an Oxford University professor who believes aliens are here and walking amongst us. I also talked to a member of the Association for the Scientific Study of Anomalous Phenomena, who joined me to discuss sliders. These are high-voltage people who wreak havoc on electronics and appliances and can cause electrical disturbances around them. If you missed it, why not become a Coast Insider? It costs just about 15 cents a day, and then you can download and listen to previous episodes at any time. Go to coasttocoastam.com. Now, I'll be back in the air chair on Coast to Coast AM June 14th, that's a Friday, Saturday, June 15th, and then again Friday, June the 28th. While evolution and neo-Darwinism has become a kind of dogma across the sciences, a lot of the conclusions are based on inferences and guesses rather than actual evidence. According to Jeffrey K. Lyons, interestingly, Darwin never even used the word evolution until the sixth edition of his book on the Origin of Species and was critical of the term. Darwin argued that species are modified over time in natural selection, but it was the philosopher Herbert Spencer who pushed the term evolution, which Lyons finds is used in an unscientific manner. Jeffrey K. Lyons is a graduate of the University of Hawaii at Manoa and Regent University, where he earned a PhD in communication. He has taught at Hawaii Pacific University, Argosy University, Honolulu, and Honolulu Community College. He has published articles in the Global Media Journal, Journal of Radio and Audio Media, and the Hawaiian Journal of History. He is the author of Evolution Myths, A Critical View of Neo-Darwinism. Jeffrey Lyons, welcome to Conspiracy Unlimited. How are you?
I'm doing terrific. Thank you, Richard. Glad to be here.
Let's start with some definitions. Now, we will talk about the fact that the term evolution was never really used by Darwin until much later. But just for our own edification, let's define what we mean by microevolution versus macroevolution.
Great question. So microevolution is very easy to see and observe. For example, if you talk about dogs or if you talk about cats, it's very easy to see. There's a huge variety with cats and the same with dogs, you know, different breeds of dogs. I want a golden retriever, I want a Rottweiler, so on and so forth. So that's a good example of microevolution. Macroevolution is technically, they call it above the species level. So that's when one species becomes a different species, and then they can't interbreed anymore. In other words, dogs can make other dogs, cats can make other cats, but you can't interbreed a dog with some other creature. Just doesn't work. So macroevolution is above the species level, and that's where other species, according to Darwin's theory, are created.
So with microevolution, and I guess the example would be, you know, Darwin studying these finches on the Galapagos Island, and he noticed variations in beak size. Some had thick beaks, some had thinner beaks.
Yeah. That one's been around for a long time and well talked about, well documented. And sure, you know, the finches had different beak size and they're given different reasons. And there's another one about moths in London and adapting lighter to darker color moths. And that's fine. But at the end of the day, it's still an example of microevolution. The finches are still finches,
right?
Whether the beak is long or short. And the moths in London, they're still moths, whether they have dark wings or light wings.
Exactly.
The real question is, you know, macro evolution? And that's a more difficult question.
Well, I just wanted to come back to micro for a moment, because is there new information being added to the gene pool with a mutation like that? Or is it something that's, for example, every finch has it in its capacity, I suppose, to develop a different beak size? Or is it new information being added to the gene pool?
Well, I mean, that's a terrific question. In terms of the finches, I don't have an answer because I haven't looked at that. However, and remember, of course, Darwin had no idea that there was even something called the gene pool. Genetics had not even wasn't even on the table. That research had not come out. So Darwin wasn't aware of it. He had a different idea about how traits were passed on, and that entire chapter in his book is wrong. But if you go back to microbiology, I can address that question because there's a lot of interesting information there about gene pools and even at the microbiology level.
All right. Maybe we will have an opportunity to circle back and drill down on that a little bit. But I just wanted to first, you know, establish micro versus macro. And then
right.
The other question that jumps out is, you know, why someone with a PhD in communications, not a science background, would enter this arena?
Well, I mean, it's a perfectly valid question. And I have a good friend, Dr. Ralph Kam, who said, hey, well, why'd you want to write this book? Why did you spend 7 years writing this book, Evolution Myths, Critical View of Neo-Darwinism? And basically, the reason I wrote it was because when I looked at the social sciences, when I looked at just various areas of research, it became apparent that this is no longer a biological theory. I mean, you can see it in astronomy. You know, the astronomers talk about evolution, and you can see it in psychology. There are people that call themselves evolutionary psychologists. You see it in sociology. So it's in the social sciences. My field is in the social sciences. So I said, aha, okay, you're in the field where I am. You're open to criticism. You're open for me to take a look. So what I argue in my book is that evolution is no longer a biological theory. It has become what researchers call a meta theory. It's just a fancy word for saying it's a theory of theories. It's stepped outside of biology, and it's touching on all these other fields.
It's almost become a religion. Wouldn't you agree?
Well, yeah. I mean, in terms of ideology, a lot of people would say it has, because those that adhere to it strongly adhere to it, and it's very hard for them to hear the criticism. But what I did in my book, I've got over 275 sources, scholarly sources, and these are people who are scientists, many of them who adhere to evolution. Now, they adhere to it publicly, but then when you dig deep into the research, into their scientific articles, into their books, what you find out is they've got questions about it. They've got problems that they say, hey, this hasn't been addressed, and we really have an issue here. In fact, what we're finding, there's actually a survey, a 1,000 scientists have signed a petition. Petition's a correct word, and they're saying, "Hey, there's problems with evolution and Darwin's theory, and we should begin to do some additional research and question what's out there." And that's just look for petition and Darwin and evolution. You'll find it. It's on the internet. It's out there.
As you point out in the book, Darwin never used the term until, I think it was the 6th edition of Origin of the Species, but for nearly 4 decades, he never used the term evolution. So who came up with that?
That's absolutely correct. Darwin wrote his book in 1859, That was his first edition of On the Origin of Species. I actually had a much longer title than that. It wasn't until his sixth edition, as you say, in 1889, that Darwin actually used the term evolution. So 37 years went by, and Richard, probably a number of your listeners, you know, they may not be 37 years old, or maybe they're just a few years past that. I mean, that's a long time to wait to use that term, evolution. The person who came up with that term was a philosopher, and he was not a natural scientist like Darwin. I mean, Darwin studied barnacles for 4 years and wrote a book on barnacles. You know, how exciting is that? I actually bought a copy of the book. And that's the kind of person he was. I mean, he really was a scientist. And but anyway, Herbert Spencer was a philosopher. He's the founder or the father of modern sociology. So people out there in your audience that are sociology majors have probably heard of him. But it was Spencer who came up with the term evolution. And Spencer promoted the term. Darwin did not like the term at all. He was highly critical of that term. And I talk about this in the first chapter of my book. Spencer used a different methodology than Darwin did. And I know I'm throwing out fancy terms here, but methodology is basically, you know, how scientists go from A to B and make conclusions. How do they gather the evidence? How do they make sense out of the evidence? And then how do they report their findings? Well, Spencer did not use the scientific method. Darwin did. Darwin used a method that was developed by a philosopher named Francis Bacon that lived in the 16th century. And that's how we get our modern scientific method. You do research, you gather data, you crunch the data, you report the findings, and then you put it out there. And you use a hypothesis, and you test the hypothesis. That wasn't Spencer's idea of doing research. Spencer basically just said evolution's true because it's true. So I know it sounds wild, but that's what he did. And what Spencer did was he used a methodology that philosophers call deductive reasoning, which means you go from something general, evolution is true, to something specific. Something specific would be dogs came from something prior to dogs. Darwin went from something specific to something general. That's the scientific method, and it's called inductive reasoning. I know I'm throwing out a lot of technical terms here, but this is easy to look up,
right,
the difference
right.
between inductive and deductive reasoning. And Darwin, he was so against Spencer that he couldn't take it for 37 years. And then I guess Darwin's, you know, towards the end of his life, Spencer was out there speaking public. He was pushing his views. And the irony is that Spencer's term became much more common. And so he had to, I guess Darwin succumbed to it. And so today, the irony is today, we all think that evolution was advanced, or the term was created by Darwin, but it wasn't. It was created by Spencer.
So then in Origin of the Species, what was Darwin positing that germs can become great apes? Or was he strictly talking about adaptation, natural selection, and variation within a species?
Well, Darwin's theory was called descent with modification. Probably you haven't heard of that.
I have not.
Well, that was his theory. His theory was not called evolution. It was called descent with modification. And so he did posit that there were simpler creatures, and that over time something called natural selection, which Spencer also changed that term, and then Spencer called it survival of the fittest, and then that term caught on. But Darwin said natural selection was the driving factor or the force behind descent with modification, and that over time things, creatures change. Now, the idea has been around prior to Darwin. Lamarck had was a scientist that advanced a similar idea, but Darwin proposed natural selection, and Lamarck said, well, it was the environment and time, and people just, that didn't bite. So prior to Darwin, creation. The creation was the prevailing view, more of a biblical kind of view. And Darwin introduced natural selection and said, no, the creation is not a part of it. There wasn't a creator involved. It was a natural process. And that was the radical change. Let me just read you real quick what Darwin says about Spencer. He says, nevertheless, I'm not conscious of having profited in my own work by Spencer's writings. His deductive manner of treating every subject is wholly opposed to my frame of mind. His conclusions never convince me, and over again, I have to say to myself after reading one of his discussions, here would be a fine subject for half a dozen years' work. And Darwin's saying, Spencer, you talk about a lot of subjects, but why don't you write about something else? That's kind of what he's saying there. Between the lines. Yeah, it's really funny how scholars take a stab at each other. Darwin goes on and says, his fundamental generalizations, he's talking about Spencer, which have been compared in importance to persons with Newton's laws. Here he's being sarcastic. He's saying, oh my goodness, Spencer, you're so grandiose in your statements that some people are comparing you to Newton, you know, one of the greatest, if not the greatest scientist that's ever lived. And it's tongue-in-cheek. Darwin's making fun of him, which I dare say may be very valuable to a philosophical point of view. Of such nature, they do not seem to me to be of any scientific use. Now, get this. Darwin is saying that Spencer's ideas do not seem to be of any strictly scientific use. And then he explains why. He says, they do not aid one in predicting what will happen in any particular case. So that's the thing about the scientific method. You've got theory, you gather information, you crunch the data, and then you're able to say, you know, was the hypothesis supported or was it not supported? And then can you make a prediction? And Darwin's saying, well, this idea of evolution that Spencer's put out there, it has no scientific use, and you can't even make any predictions. And Spencer, you're a smart guy. Why don't you write about something else and stay out of biology?
Right, right.
So, Darwin was not a fan of Spencer.
No, to say the least. Yeah, it's a pretty damning critique.
It is, and that's in Darwin's own words. That's in his very own words. Yeah.
Every town has a dark side. This is Andrew Fitzgerald from the Every Town podcast, where every single week we dive into insane and mysterious true crime stories, most of which you've never heard of. Stories like the bizarre disappearance of Tyler Davis in Columbus, Ohio, a 29-year-old father trying to find his way back to his hotel when he disappeared and was never heard from again, and Elizabeth Schoaf from Lugoff, South Carolina, who was abducted from her driveway by a madman and taken to his underground bunker in the woods. And we give you all the details you're interested in hearing about without any fluff or fillers, because ain't nobody got time for that. We cover everything from psychopaths to poltergeists, So go check out the Every Town podcast, because every town, no matter how nice it may seem, has a dark side.
We all enjoy a little mystery. Every other week, One Strange Thing presents forgotten stories from America's newspaper archives. They all have something in common, a single element that can't quite be explained. Join us on One Strange Thing, and you'll hear about a man who was literally stricken with genius. A 21st century child who remembered piloting a World War II bomber. A mysterious, unidentifiable blob in Texas. And then there was the lizard man stalking through small-town South Carolina. From cryptids and disappearances to modern-day miracles, One Strange Thing brings you stories that are very real and just a little otherworldly. Subscribe now, wherever you listen.
All right, I'll get back to my conversation with Jeffrey K. Lyons about evolution and Darwin in just a moment. Stay with us. So the other night, I went out for drinks with a colleague, and he was stunned when he learned how old I am. No way, he said. Way, I responded. What's your secret, he asked, and then I told him what I've been telling you for the last several months. My secret? Life Change Tea and Formula 13 Teas from GetTheTea.com. You see, they work from the inside of the body, providing a gentle cleanse every day that helps support people with constipation, indigestion, acid reflux, and bloating. And cleansing the colon is key because good health starts with good digestion and a healthy gut. And people say I have clearer, healthier, younger looking skin. And I can absolutely confirm that I have seen a dramatic increase in my energy. How do I keep looking and feeling so young? Life Change Tea and Formula 13 Teas. Organic, non-GMO, caffeine-free herbal teas from GetTheTea.com. Order yours today. Use the code word UNLIMITED. And your first purchase ships for free. Life Change Tea and Formula 13 Teas from GetTheTea.com.
Theoretical physicists say that there is as many as 12 hyperdimensions. Here are just three of them. Conspiracy Unlimited. Conspiracy Unlimited. Conspiracy Unlimited. Pretty cool, huh? Here's an extra one. Conspiracy Unlimited. Hey, how about one more? Conspiracy Unlimited. And the great thing is we have six hyperdimensions left. Conspiracy Unlimited.
Five.
Or something like that. I'll ask Richard later.
Now, back to my conversation with Jeffrey K. Lyons, PhD, and author of Evolution Myths, A Critical View of Neo-Darwinism.
I'm not a biologist, certainly, or a geneticist, but I mean, the idea that a mutation can get, you know, passed on from one generation to the next, and
when I
think of mutation, I think of something that is generally, it could be very innocuous, like an eye color, it could be something harmful, or it could be something fatal. So, how does a mutation, you know, turn germs into humans?
That's a great question. That is a great question. And what I'm going to do here is I'm going to turn to the National Academy of Sciences to try and answer your question. You're going to love this. So I have a book in front of me, and I'm surrounded by about 30 of my favorite books. And this book is called Science, Evolution, and Creationism. It's written by the National Academy of Sciences Institute of Medicine. And there's a lot of real smart people that wrote this book. You can actually download it free online and get a PDF. I actually bought a hard copy, but you don't need to. So the book's out there, Science, Evolution, and Creationism, National Academy of Sciences Institute of Medicine. They wrote it. So here they are trying to answer your question, and you go back to how life began and how these traits are passed on, this sort of thing, and they're trying to say that evolution is a fact. Now, listen very careful in this quote. Listen for these phrases. No one yet knows. The word might, the word if, the word could, the word perhaps, and the word might have. Because the thing about evolution is that, and this is why myself, as a scholar of communication, this is why I'm studying it, is because it really is more of a story. It's a narrative. It's not so much scientific fact as it's a story. So here they are, the National Academy of Sciences. They're trying to explain the origin of life and how this thing got started. And they say, no one yet knows which combination of molecules first met these conditions. But researchers have shown how this process might have worked by studying a molecule known as RNA. Researchers recently discovered some RNA molecules can greatly increase the rate of specific chemical reactions, including replication parts of other RNA molecules, if a molecule like RNA could reproduce itself, perhaps with the assistance of other molecules, it could form the basis for a very simple living organism if such replicators were packaged within chemical vesicles, whatever those are, or membranes. They might have formed protocells, early versions of simple cells. Changes in these molecules could lead to variants. And it goes on, and they say natural selection would begin to operate. Well, this doesn't sound very convincing.
A lot of ifs, buts, and woulds. What a coulda, shoulda. What a coulda, shoulda.
And these are the smartest scientists in the United States saying that evolution is a fact. And so I kind of, what I did was I used these words, and the words that I kind of emphasize in my reading, might, if, could, perhaps, might have. Okay, now imagine you're a prosecutor and you're trying to convict a defendant of a crime, okay?
Right.
And so you're doing your summary at the end of the trial. We've all seen those on television. And the prosecutor stands up and says, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, you've heard the evidence of this case presented. Even though no one yet knows if Mr. Smith committed the crime, I ask you to return a verdict of guilty. In fact, Mr. Smith might have committed the crime. Further, he could have been at the scene of the crime, and we could be certain of the facts if someone saw Mr. Smith at the scene of the crime on the night of the incident. Perhaps Mr. Smith is guilty because he might have committed the crime. You know, this is the best they have. The smartest minds in science. And this is the best they have. So to get to your question about, you know, gene pools and how was it passed on from one generation to another, oh my goodness, they don't even know how life got started. They have absolutely no idea. I mean, it's laughable. It truly is, and I'm not pulling any punches here. One of my goals as a university professor, and it was right there in our syllabus on the first page, was to teach students to use higher critical thinking skills. Use critical, and I know your audience is a smart audience. You got a smart group of people out there. So all you have to do is look at the literature on evolution from the people that believe in evolution and advance evolution, and you can see the holes in it. Let me give you another example of traits being passed from generation to generation. I just did my genealogy, and I was at, personally, I was able to trace it back to the Mayflower. So I'm a Mayflower descendant. But that took a lot of work. I had to trace, you know, this person married to that person, this child, that child, this birth certificate, so on. Okay, so I can go back to 1620. It's going to be 400 years next year. But they're talking about going back millions and millions and millions of years. Can we say for certainty that this, any creature that we can trace, this is their parent, this is their parent, this is their parent, this is their child, going back millions of years? I mean, it's actually absurd. It's just not possible.
Right.
Where are the records? Where are the people that observed it? Where was it written down? You know, I mean, it's hard enough. It's hard enough for someone to trace their ancestry back to, you know, the Mayflower or any, you know,
exactly.
major event
exactly.
In the past. Now, you're in Canada, and something really amazing happened in Canada. And this was, okay, this was in 1954, okay? There was a discovery in 1954, and a paper published, and it was at the Schreiber Beach, Ontario, on the north shore of Lake Superior. You probably know where that is.
I've been around Lake Superior, yes. I haven't been to Schreiber Beach, but I know the north shore.
So this is absolutely amazing. Okay, 1954, I wasn't born. So they're actually looking for oil. Schreiber Beach, north, the north side of Lake Superior. And there's a Gunflint Formation that overlooks Lakeshore, Canada. And this revolutionized science came right out of Canada. Today, they found microscopic life, fossilized life of bacteria back in 1954, going back 2 billion years. 2 billion
wow.
years. And they examined these rock samples. They were sliced to 0.03 millimeters, and they examined it under the microscope. Now, were these guys looking for microscopic life? The answer is no. They were actually looking for oil or coal. Yeah, actually coal. So it was complete serendipity. They found this. And then, oh my goodness, they found microscopic life. And what it was bacteria. Bacteria. And what we found, what scientists have found, they've actually found other samples in Australia, other parts of the world. Bacteria as old as 3.5 billion years since 1954. And they've found that bacteria were the first forms of life on Earth. But get this, bacteria have not changed since they first appeared on Earth 3.5 billion years ago. It's kind of...
They haven't
wrap
evolved.
Wrap our heads around that one. No change.
Well, they haven't...
3.5, yeah.
They have adapted because now we know they can become
yes.
resistant to antibiotics. They've adapted,
yes,
but they
absolutely.
Haven't changed. They haven't changed.
But that's micro, that's the beginning of our conversation. That's microevolution. So the bacteria are still bacteria.
Exactly.
They do adapt and they do change, but they're still bacteria. And so essentially, and Darwin's theory said that they change into another species over time, so on and so forth. They even talk about Iluka, the last universal common ancestor. But bacteria, which we know about, which is everywhere, essentially hasn't changed. Cyanobacteria is the rock star. What is cyanobacteria? We call it blue-green algae.
Ah, yes.
But it was around for a billion years. And you know this stuff we breathe in every day that keeps us alive?
Yes.
Oxygen.
Heard of it, yes.
Cyanobacteria made the oxygen.
Wow.
It took cyanobacteria about a billion years to make it. But life, the life we have today, the oxygen we breathe, we wouldn't even be alive if it were not for bacteria. So, and it's kind of funny. I mean, why get excited about bacteria? Because, you know, mostly we think of stuff like strep throat, and that's a type of bacteria. Another E. coli is another type of bacteria. But cyanobacteria, it's still making oxygen today.
Well, the cool thing about bacteria is because they have such a short lifespan that you could,
yeah.
you know, people say, well, you can't study evolution in a lab, but you could because you could study, you know, tens of thousands of generations under lab conditions of E. coli, for example.
Perfect example. And they've done that. And what happens is that the bacteria remain bacteria. The bacteria don't change. They don't change into something else. Now you could find study after study that says, well, they work in colonies. They start to communicate with each other. They work in groups, and yeah, they do cluster. Yeah, but there's a there's a distinction between a cell called bacteria, which is called a prokaryote. It's kind of a weird word, prokaryote, and the type of cells that are in our body. Okay, those are called eukaryotes. And the big difference between the two is prokaryotes, what's in a bacteria, they have no nucleus. There's a number of other things that are different, but that's the big one. When you look up the definition on Encyclopedia Britannica, very simple. Prokaryotes, bacteria, no nucleus. The types of cells in our bodies, they do have a nucleus. Evolution does not have an explanation for this. The evolution has no explanation for how life got started, and they have no explanation for how life went from bacteria to the types of cells in our bodies. The types of cells in our body are as large as 500 times larger, and they use up far more energy. Up to 200,000 times more energy than bacterial cells. I mean, it's just stunning how different these, and the cells in bacteria are asexual. They reproduce by something called lateral gene transfer. And I'm not going to try and explain that.
No, it's a family show, please.
Yeah, it's a family show. The cells that are in our body, the ones with nucleuses, they reproduce through sexual reproduction. So, it goes on and on and on.
Right, that's a big problem.
Big problem. There is a theory out there called endosymbiosis. I know I'm throwing a lot of scientific terms, but someone could easily look that one up. Endosymbiosis. Lynn Margulis, she passed away. She was a biologist. It came up with this theory. You're going to love this one, Richard. Your listeners are going to love this. So how did the larger, more complex cell, the type of cell that's in our body, how did it come about? And you can see this. It's endosymbiosis. Look it up. Okay, it's got a picture of one little bacteria. I'm not making this up. A picture of one bacteria. It bumps into another bacteria. Then, kind of like a Pac-Man, one bacteria swallows the other bacteria. And then, no one knows how, suddenly it becomes a cell with a nucleus. Well, that argument just doesn't fly. It's actually quite laughable.
They're taking quite a leap there.
Oh, they're taking an enormous leap, but it's like children's cartoons. But you see it on major university websites. You see it in high school textbooks. You see it in university textbooks in the major universities. Look at it this way. Here's the criticism, and these come from people that are evolutionary biologists. Lane and Martin, 2010. Here's what they say. Put another way, a eukaryotic gene, okay, that's the type of cell that has a nucleus, eukaryote, commands 200,000 times more energy than a prokaryotic gene. That's the type of gene that would be in an amoeba. 200,000 times more energy. So they say the implications for complexity can hardly be overstated, whereas prokaryotes, that's bacteria, frequently make starts towards eukaryotic complexity, they rarely exhibit more complex than one trait at a time. Then they go on to say eukaryote common ancestors increased in genetic repertoire 3,000 novel gene families. So, okay, one bacteria swallows another, and suddenly the genes become 3,000 times, they create 3,000 times new gene families, and they have 200,000 times more energy, and the cell is 500 times larger. How does that happen?
Well, exactly, because when I hear that, what comes to my mind is physics and the law of entropy, and all things tend towards decay. And yet, if everything is sort of decaying and slowing down and getting less energy and less energy, where does this new energy input come in order to, you know, grow new limbs where there weren't limbs before, et cetera? Where is that energy coming from if all things tend towards decay?
How does a bacterial cell eat another bacterial cell and become a cell with a nucleus like the types of cells in our body? And even more troubling, the DNA gets recoded. And they ask the question, where did the complexity and the coding information come from? There's no theory. There's this cartoonish example or theory called endosymbiosis. But here's the thing, it's never been observed in nature. It's never been observed in a laboratory. The theory's been around since 1970. It's in all the textbooks, and they're holding on to this theory. But as the research progresses and microbiologists really dig into what's going on inside of cells, they're finding, this theory doesn't hold. And so it's a big problem, but they're not going to tell undergraduate school students at a university that we have no explanation for how bacteria became a cell with a nucleus. I mean, in my book, I call this the three barriers to life. And I mean, first barrier is just to get to life. We read the, you know, the conclusive, you know,
right. Biogenesis, life begets life, but they want us to believe that, well, in the beginning, there was no life, and then there was life.
Yeah, and abiogenesis, basically, Pasteur said that spontaneous generation didn't, he proved a number of years ago, over a century ago, that wasn't the case. Interestingly enough, because you mentioned biogenesis, and I mentioned Pasteur, there was discoverer of DNA. His name is Francis Crick. Now, he wrote a book, which I hold right here in my hand, Life Itself. And I hope some of your listeners, and I know they are, your listeners are critical thinkers. They're smart people. They can look up this book, Life Itself, Its Origin and Nature, by Francis Crick. And I checked this out at a local university, and it could be in a local university right there in Canada. This is the co-discoverer of DNA. And Crick himself says that he does not believe that DNA had a natural cause. He says it's too complex. He says, I see no natural cause. Basically, what he's doing is he's throwing Darwin under the bus,
or at least Spencer.
Exactly. And that's really interesting. And so, well, okay, but we are alive. So if it wasn't naturally caused, then how do we get here? And interestingly enough, and you've probably had this because you've had a lot of guests on your show, he says it was panspermia.
Right.
That's what
right.
Crick says. You know, but you got to come up with some kind of explanation. And and that's the way he went. So on the cover of his book, he's got the Earth. Then he's got a little asteroid circling the Earth and then hitting the Earth. It's either an asteroid or a little spaceship. And he thinks that the Earth was seeded with life somehow from somewhere else. It's just, in a way, and I know you've had guests on it, on this subject that has delved into it much deeper than I, but, you know, again, if you don't believe it's Darwinian cause, you got to come up with some other cause, or you go with some faith-based cause that there was a creator.
Well,
limited list.
Exactly.
I'm Andrew Gold, a fallen BBC journalist interviewing the heretics and rebels brave enough to speak out against mainstream narratives. Here's Coleman Hughes, John Ronson, and the Trigonometry podcast guys bringing controversy to the fore.
How'd you feel if a person of a different race moved in next door?
I spent a while with a politically correct faction of the Ku Klux Klan.
The system punishes people for wrongthink. It's heartbreaking.
Here's My Unorthodox Life Netflix star Julia Hart on getting out of a Hasidic Jewish cult.
Why can't I be okay with being silent and subservient? Everyone else is.
And biologist Richard Dawkins on trans activism.
It's perfectly legitimate to say, I am a man, but I feel feminine. But to then say, therefore I am a woman, is just a betrayal of language.
Now it's your turn. Rebel against the mainstream and find a home in this sensible alternative space by subscribing to Heretics Podcast.
Have you ever wondered why we call French fries French fries? Or why something is the greatest thing since sliced bread? There are answers to those questions. Everything Everywhere Daily is a podcast for curious people who want to learn more about the world around them. Every day, you'll learn something new about things you never knew you didn't know. Subjects include history, science, geography, mathematics, and culture. If you're a curious person and want to learn more about the world you live in, just subscribe to Everything Everywhere Daily wherever you cast your pod.
Overwhelmed by investing?
If you're anything like us, the hardest part is getting started. That's why we created the Investing for Beginners podcast.
Our goal is to help simplify money so it can work for you.
We invite guests to demystify investing.
At least try to be setting aside like the minimum 10% into the 401k.
We'll teach you the basics of the market.
Yeah, I think compound interest should be at the start of any discussion about investing. And
we've had investment professionals who teach in a simple way.
A valuation-driven bear market, you know, we haven't really seen yet, and I think everyone's thinking about it, but we haven't really seen yet.
Our Q&A episodes feature questions from listeners just like you.
So what do you think about the situation with ETBI, which is Activision?
I'm Dave Ahern.
And I'm Andrew Sather.
And we hope you join us on the Investing for Beginners podcast.
On the Investing for Beginners podcast.
Well, the problem with panspermia is, okay, so the bacteria got here from somewhere else, but that doesn't explain how we got here. And even if we were... we came from another planet. How did we get there? Did we evolve? So we're right back to square one. And
exactly.
And the other thing that there was a wonderful book written a number of years ago. I can't remember the title, but the idea was, if you look at the human body and the complexity, you mentioned DNA,
right.
And we haven't even talked about consciousness and speech and these things. Now, the brain more complex than any computer we could ever conceive of. And yet it's like that this book made the analogy that, you know, this idea that we are random. You know, imagine a tornado touching down in a junkyard and it assembles a 747 Boeing jet. And that's not even, I mean, we're more complex than a Boeing 747, but I think it's a brilliant analogy. Just ridiculous to think about, you know, that something that random, a tornado could touch down in a junkyard and put together a jumbo jet.
Exactly. It becomes absurd. In many ways, if you look at just the bacterial cell, the cell that scientists have said has been around for 3.5 billion years, a bacterial cell is more complex than the city of Toronto, the city of London, the city of New York. How can that be? Well, yes, it is more complex because scientists have never been able to construct a bacterial cell. Engineers, laborers can build Toronto, New York, London, but nobody can build a cell. Now, there's always people out there saying, well, give it time, they'll figure it out. Well, they haven't. So, you know, if they do, that will be interesting, but that has not happened.
Then there's the issue of irreducible complexity. I mean, the human eye, this wonderful right. organ, I mean, without, you know, if it wasn't formed instantaneously exactly the way it was, it wouldn't work. What, did we have creatures walking around with inoperating eyeballs? I mean, talk to me a little bit about that conundrum of irreducible complexity.
Well, the human eye is a great example. And, of course, Michael Behe is the one that put out that term irreducible complexity in his book, Darwin's Black Box. It really goes back to the argument by design. And that argument has been around for quite some time. And actually, the philosopher Richard Dawkins, he mocks the argument by design in his book, The Blind Watchmaker. Probably your listeners are familiar with that book. But irreducible complexity is just a modern version of the argument by design. And that argument says that if, for example, if you're walking along a beach and you see a clock, and you pick up the clock and you examine it, that there's a designer behind it, that there's a designer behind it, that the watch didn't just pop up out of the beach. Irreducible complexity says something as complex as the flagellum, which propels the bacteria, which has been compared to a motor, that if all the... You need certain components or it would never work. It would never work at all. And really what it does is it points to a designer because there are no steps prior to that. You need all these components to make that flagellum work, to propel the bacteria. It's also been compared to a mousetrap. If you don't have certain parts to the mousetrap, it just won't work at all. So there's many different ways to look at that. But, it's the argument by design, which was Paley, P-A-L-E-Y. He was the person that put out that argument. Darwin was aware of the argument by design. In fact, he read about it in his studies at an undergraduate level. And he actually liked Paley's argument. And I think that's why Darwin himself... mentioned the creator in his book. It's so interesting because people try to separate Darwin and say Darwin science, religion. And when you're walking around on a university campus, it's okay. If you want to talk about religion, go over and talk to those guys in the religion and philosophy department. But if you want to talk about science, you can't talk about religion. You can only talk about science. They try to separate the two, but look what Darwin says. This is the very, I'm holding his book right in my hand, The Origin of Species. The very last sentence of his book, he says, there is grandeur in this view of life with its several powers having been originally breathed by the Creator.
There
capital
you go.
C.
Mm-hmm. There you go.
Into a few forms or into one. And that whilst this planet has gone cycling according to the fixed law of gravity from so simple a beginning, endless forms, most beautiful, most wonderful, have been and are being evolved. Did anybody ever tell me when I studied evolution at the university that Darwin talked about the Creator? Nope. Nobody told me. All I had to do was walk into a bookstore and buy it off the shelf. I mean... People can do that in Toronto.
We can. And we are bipedal.
Yeah. You are bipedal. And in the chapter, because you mentioned the eye, he spends a whole chapter on the eye in On the Origin of Species, and he says, look, if anybody can come up with facts that show that my theory doesn't hold up to the facts, he said, I'll throw out my theory. That's what a true scientist would do.
Exactly.
And he talks about the eye. And he talks about how the eye formed. And what is so interesting in his conversation, when he talks about the eye, he mentions the creator.
There you go. There you go.
Yeah, very interesting. So Darwin himself, he never said he was a religious person. I do not believe he was a religious person, but he did not shun using a topic like creator. In fact, I think if Darwin had tried to submit what he wrote, he probably would have gotten rejected from modern journals today, because you mentioned creator and you just can't do that on a university campus in the context of science. That's just not allowed. That's not permitted. We're going to shut you down.
Jeffrey, it's a good place to end this. We didn't have a chance to address consciousness and language. Well, I'd like to have you on again, because we're just barely scratching the surface. But in the meantime, how can people get a hold of Evolution Myths, A Critical View of Neo-Darwinism?
The book is on Amazon.com. It's on BarnesandNoble.com. You can go to my website, Jeffrey K. Lyons. That's all it is. It's my name with my middle initial, JeffreyKLyons.com. You're going to see blogs there with some of the information we've talked about. There is a forum if people want to interact. They can jump in there. I do look at comments, and I am very interested in hearing feedback and addressing people's questions. I am not a biologist. That is true. But as I mentioned, this is a topic which has become a meta theory, and it touches the area of communication. And really, the evidence, when you get down to it, for evolution, it comes down to storytelling and how well you can tell a story.
Evolution Myths, A Critical View of Neo-Darwinism, Amazon, and also go to JeffreyKLyons.com. Lyons spelled L-Y-O-N-S, JeffreyKLyons.com. Jeff, a great pleasure. Thank you for this.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me on. Appreciate it.
Okay, before I dim the lights in my little studio beneath the stairs, I'll be right back with a few words about the next installment of Conspiracy Unlimited. If you're a fan of this podcast, or my weekly radio program, The Conspiracy Show, or my YouTube channel, Strange Planet, I hope you'll consider becoming an official donor. A donation of $50 a month places you in the Star Chamber. $20 a month is the whistleblower tier, and a donation of just $10 per month makes you a truth seeker. Star Chamber and Whistleblower members can participate in an exclusive monthly online chat or video conference with me. And all donors are entered into a monthly draw for Strange Planet merchandise. Any monthly amount is welcome and greatly appreciated. To become an official donor, go to patreon.com/strangeplanet. patreon.com/strangeplanet. Coming up next time on Conspiracy Unlimited, a broadcaster describes his near-drowning and out-of-body experience as a child, and how that led to his lifelong interest in NDEs.
And I waded out too far, stepped off this ledge, and suddenly I was sinking. I came up once and screamed for my mother. I was terrified. When all that air from the scream went out of my lungs, I just sank. Down to the bottom of the lake. But suddenly I found that I was sitting up in a birch tree by the cottage, watching as my mother, who had fortunately heard me, ran down the stairs and down to the shore in her red dress, dove in, found me, dragged me out, and threw my body down over a log and was pumping on my back, almost embedded CPR, because, of course, back then nobody knew CPR. But she figured she needed to get the water out of my lungs, as she explained later.
Until then, I'm Richard Serrett. So long for now.
A new Conspiracy Unlimited with Richard Serrett drops every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday at conspiracyunlimitedpodcast.com. Blow your mind. That is all for now. Oh, and remember to share and give a 5-star review, because we have huge egos and need love. We're like cats. We need constant petting.